Welcome to the Terrorist Therapist Show on Renegade Talk Radio with your host, Dr. Carol. Though you may not realize that the ongoing threat of terrorism is affecting your life and that of your loved ones. Each week, Dr. Carol analyzes the hottest topics in terror and helps you and your family reach your dreams despite living in a time of terror.
New Zealand terrorist on my couch. Welcome to the Terrorist Therapist Show. I'm Dr. Carol, a psychiatrist, and you are a terrorist therapist. Well, today we're going to be talking about the New Zealand terrorist. Incredible tragedy, of course. And he has an incredibly interesting background. I'm going to be talking to you about that. I'll give you a little tease, a little preview here of how I have analyzed him and what I think is wrong with him. Of course, what's basically wrong is that he has an incredible amount of hatred in him. But the interesting thing as a psychiatrist is, where did all of this come from? So let me give you this little tease. His manifesto, he wrote a manifesto and he sent it to the Prime Minister of the head of New Zealand and media outlets. And he opened the document with a poem or words from a poem, "Do not go gentle into that good night." Now, that poem is, as you may know, written by Dylan Thomas. And it was an ode to his dying father, imploring him not to die. Now, how does that fit? I know what you're thinking. What? What is she talking about? What does that have to do with this horrendous mass shooting of all of these people in the mosque in New Zealand? Well, I will get to that. But first, let me talk a little bit about what actually happened. This mass shooting took place in Christchurch in two mosques. It was actually one mosque after another that the shooter went to. He chose, of course, a time when there are lots of people in the mosques for Friday prayer. He began the attacks at Al Noor Mosque at 1:40 in the afternoon and then continued on to the Linwood Islamic Center at 1:55. He killed 50 people, injured 50 more. There were 42 people who died at the Al Noor Mosque, 7 people who died at the Linwood Islamic Center, and 1 died in the hospital. And then there were 50 more who were injured, but not fatally. So, as you know, I usually talk about radical Islamists, not other kinds of terrorists, but Brenton Tarrant, that was a Freudian slip. Brenton Tarrant certainly was he's still alive, but his rampage was an act of terror. And it's similar to the school shooters because they also create acts of terror. Now, he is 28 years old. And what I'm going to be talking to you about is how both his childhood and his travels combined to turn him into a man who would commit this mass shooting. Let's see. One of the things that's going back to the shooting itself, though, I wanted to mention, New Zealand is considered the second most safest country in the world behind Iceland. So, of course, this incredible, horrendous mass shooting, which was considered the most severe in its modern history, was shocking to happen in such a country. Their Islam is practiced by 46,000 New Zealanders, which is 1.2% of the population. There are over 3,000 people in Christchurch who are Muslim. The Al-Nur Mosque, where he first started his rampage, opened in 1985, but then the Linwood Islamic Center opened more recently in 2018. And now, as I tweeted when the news first came across, obviously this was an act by a man who thought the New Zealand authorities weren't doing enough to control the immigrants. And he saw, as I'll tell you more about, he saw how this destroyed Europe, all of this mass immigration. And that led to fear and rage in him. And he decided to take matters into his own hands. And how that relates to his father, I will tell you later on. So, as you may know, while he was committing this rampage, he live streamed it. He live streamed the first 17 minutes of the attack on Facebook Live. And of course, then people went to it, especially, you know, as it was in the news, everybody started searching for it, right? And it got on other websites, and there were other places that you could see it. It was very hard for people to watch, and yet they all tuned in to watch it, you know, like an accident on the side of the road. But anyhow, and of course now there is all of this controversy, yet more controversy against Facebook, and why does Facebook Live exist? Why do they let these videos go out live? Any videos go out live? Perhaps there should be some kind of a delay. There's a complaint that Facebook didn't take it down quickly enough. And so all of that is going to be going on and is a result of this. One of the things that's interesting is that before, as he was driving to the mosque and these 17 minutes on Facebook Live, start with him driving to the mosque and end with him driving away. And moments before he started shooting, he played a traditional marching song of the British military called the British Grenadiers. And he played some other songs too, but this is particularly significant, in my opinion, because I think a lot of this had to do with his relationship with his father, as I hinted at by the poem, and his saying that his father, his ancestry, was British, Scottish, and Irish. And in some reports, he talks about his father being British, or he certainly at least felt that his ancestry was particularly British. And so you will see where this is going. Well, now let me get into his childhood, because this is the key. And this is, of course, you know, as a psychiatrist, it's always in your childhood, whatever it is that you, whatever traumas or trouble you get into as an adult, problems, look towards your childhood, look back at your childhood for its roots. I mean, you know, yes, Freud said this 100 years ago, and it is as true today as it was when he first discovered it. And I can tell you this based upon not only studying at Freud's, well, at his daughter's, Anna Freud's center in London, but also, and of course his books, but also my experience as a psychiatrist with hundreds, thousands of patients. Maybe not thousands of patients per se, but certainly thousands of evaluations, you know, forensic evaluations and so on. So anyhow, it is true that you can always see a pattern between things that happen in a person's childhood. Now, what's interesting is that he describes his childhood as a regular childhood. And that there was nothing unusual, you know, don't look, basically he was saying in his manifesto, like, don't look into my childhood, you won't find the roots of this there, I had a regular childhood. You know, he was trying to sort of whitewash his childhood, and in fact, he may well have thought that it was, although that even seems difficult to believe. He has the typical kinds of pattern that mass shooters have. Parents getting divorced, an addiction to violent media, violent video games, problems with his dysfunctional relationships with his mother and his father, although he loved his father, but also had problems with him. And then of course the travels is what gave him the direction for his rage from his childhood, and caused him to focus it on these mosques in New Zealand. Now, we'll get back, we'll get more into his childhood and into his travels and understand how all of these things came together to turn him into New Zealand's worst mass shooter in modern times. So stay tuned. Welcome back. We are talking today about the New Zealand terrorist, putting him on my couch, analyzing him. And of course, any good analysis starts with his childhood. Now, I have been doing a lot of research on this and gathering tidbits, facts from different reports. And, you know, of course, not all of them agree with each other. But there are enough things that are consistent that I can put together his childhood and the problems therein, despite the fact that he claims to have had made the point, not just claims, but in his manifesto, he claims to have made the point that he had such a regular childhood, okay? So you may have seen the picture of him. There's a picture going around of him being held by his father. He looks like this adorable blonde-headed kid, floppy hair, and you know, being hugged by his father, held up in the air, his father's hugging him. And his mother says that this picture came from when the family were together in Hawaii, where his father was about to compete in an Ironman triathlon. Now, the mother said this is one of her fondest memories, this picture. And Brendan Tarrant had just celebrated his birthday. Now, so, and it's funny because some media outlets are, you know, believing him and saying that he had a normal upbringing in the rural town of Grafton, which is in New South Wales, which is in Australia. He was only living in New Zealand for about the past 2 years or so. He was originally from Australia. And as I was saying before, I started to explain that his parents divorced early in his life. And, you know, I know there are a lot of people who are divorced, who want to say that divorce doesn't leave scars on children. Well, you know, that's to make themselves feel better, that if they're divorced, that they did not leave scars on their children. But I can tell you that it does. I'm not saying that all children of divorced parents grow up to be mass murderers, but there are scars. And in all of the mass murderers, nothing to do with terrorism of any sort necessarily, but just looking at people who committed murder, like school shooters, for example. There are always things, dysfunctional things in their childhood, but one of these things is divorce. Now, in his childhood, there's more than the divorce. He had a complex relationship with his father, as I was saying. Now, his father was a man who was, you could say, obsessed with running in triathlons. In one report I read that his father ran in 72 triathlons. And of course he was obsessed with being fit because, in order to run in all these triathlons. And he worked as a garbage man. And he died, a contributing cause to his death was asbestos poisoning, or exposure to asbestos, which caused cancer, and he had a long battle with cancer. But sticking on the triathlon issue for a minute, and his father was only 49 when he died, and Brenton was in high school. His father died in approximately 2010, and so So this was very traumatic. It was especially traumatic because although the father had this long battle with cancer, he ultimately died from suicide. Now, I have found this so far only in one report, not that I have read every single report on his family, but it's interesting that that hasn't come out in more reports. And actually, it was from his grandmother, so I tend to believe that. Grandma knows best. She is the one who said that he changed when he found his father after his father had committed suicide. Now, you know, presumably, perhaps his father, you know, felt that his fight against cancer was taking its toll and it was horrible, you know, it was a horrible way to live and so on. And he took matters into his own hands, kind of like Tarrant took matters into his own hands in terms of trying to rid New Zealand of immigrants. So it's a very tragic end to his father, a very young man. But here's the thing. Tarrant was bullied in school for being fat and for having red hair and freckles. Now, imagine what it's like to be a fat kid, being bullied for being fat, and your father is a triathlon competitor running in 72 triathlons and at least at times representing Australia in these triathlons. I mean, here we have the perfect picture of health, well, except for his exposure to asbestos, which caused cancer. And I think that that Tarrant probably believes that his father may have been exposed to some of this asbestos through his job as a garbage man. Perhaps there was some, you know, one of the places where he was picking up garbage had high asbestos content. I don't know that part, but I'm speculating on that. But he is reported in many places to have died from cancer and related to or caused by asbestos. So here you are being bullied for being fat, and meanwhile your father is running in all these triathlons. Obviously that puts up, Tarrant probably felt that his father was disappointed at him for being fat, that he wasn't good enough for his father. Now I'm not saying that his father was mean to him or abusive towards him or anything. I'm just saying that it would have made for a difficult kind of relationship, certainly. And I think that there were, there was this ambivalence. So when his father died, when someone dies who you are ambivalent over, both loving them and having these issues with them, it is harder to mourn them. After his father died, or around the time that his father was dying of cancer, so from around 2009 to 2011, Tarrant worked as a personal trainer. So he left school, he didn't go to university, and he became a personal trainer. And apparently he was a good one, and he worked with kids and so on, and you could kind of understand how he would want to work with kids. So that these kids wouldn't be bullied by other people for being fat. So he was a good one to do that. His grandmother also had some other pieces of information. She said that he was a computer nerd and he was afraid of girls. So he was afraid to talk to girls. He was afraid to interact with them, you know. He undoubtedly felt like he was going to be rejected by them. And she said that when he was addicted, she also had said that he was addicted to video games. And it's even said that he was so addicted that he would sit there and continue playing video games and wet himself, urinate on himself, because he didn't want to get up to go to the bathroom and leave the video game. The grandmother said that, you know, when he found his father after his father suicided, that he was never the same. And she begged him to go see a psychiatrist, but he wouldn't do it. I mean, this is also typical in the background of people who become shooters, mass shooters, that, you know, there is some recognition by, at best, there's usually some recognition by family members that the person needs psychiatric treatment. Oftentimes, they don't make them go. And also, sometimes, unfortunately, when they do make them go as a child or a teenager, if the person doesn't get good psychiatric treatment, then that doesn't stop their trajectory to go on to become a mass shooter anyhow. But people, you know, certainly we have seen enough examples of this, of mass shooters who have, whose problems were noted when they were younger and who weren't made to go into therapy and who then went on to be mass shooters. I mean, one, it's really important to force. I mean, you know, of course, it's better not to have to force anyone into therapy, whether it's a child, a teenager, or an adult. They kind of have to want to do it themselves. But when it's a child or a teenager, they should not have the last word as to whether or not they go into therapy. So those are some of the things. Now, his mother was an English teacher, and she is still living in Australia, where he grew up. And he has hardly visited her. After his father died, and again, I think that's the turning point in his life, his father's death, he got some inheritance from his father, and he also supposedly invested in Bitcoin, and that is how he had the money to go traveling around the world, which he did for about 7 years. And his travels, which I'm going to talk to you about in the next segment, his travels is where his direction for his Islamophobia and his hatred came into being. He was pointed in that direction by things he saw as he was traveling. But, you know, the simmering, the trauma from coming upon his father's dead father after his father suicided, plus all the things that occurred before that, the bullying, the addiction to violent video games, all of these things that I just talked about set the stage. And then he went on this trip for approximately 7 years to all kinds of countries, and that is where his direction came from. You know, in other words, the direction for his rage came from that, and then he went to New Zealand and he acted it out. So what's interesting is that although his mother writes all kinds of sweet things about him on social media, and writes sweet things in general about, you know, loving people and very, very sort of sweet kinds of things, indeed, Tarrant hasn't gone back to visit her very much. Once he came back from his trip around the world, he has not visited his mother very much. So what does that tell you? It tells you that there is some dysfunction there as well. Well, when we come back, I will now talk about the trip that he made around the world and some of the influences that he had along that way. Welcome back. Before the break and all today, we have been talking about Brenton Tarrant, who is the New Zealand terrorist, and I am putting him on my couch. I just explained to you all of the things, well, all of the things that are known so far about, that was enough. All the things that I described really are enough to explain why someone would have come from a childhood that would make them ripe for doing something violent later on. Because of these dysfunctional relationships or ambivalent relationships that I talked about in regard to his mother and father, and also his being addicted to violent video games to the point that he would urinate on himself rather than get up and go to the bathroom and interrupt his violent video game, his parents' divorce, and so on. And now I'm going to, so it was after his father's death and his shocking experience of coming upon his father after his father killed himself, while he was going through a really long, difficult battle with cancer, he then went on his way. That was, you know, that trauma, that I believe that was the turning point in his life. And that sent him on his way, and he traveled all over the world. Clearly, he had, between his father's inheritance and the investments he made in Bitcoin, he must have had a substantial amount of money, because, I mean, even if he lived simply as he was traveling. So far, there have been no reports of his working in these countries, but, you know, he could have done odd jobs, of course. But in any case, he went to all kinds of countries. He went to Europe. He went to Asia, Pakistan, North Korea. I mean, North Korea and Pakistan. Interesting choices. And he had originally described Pakistan on social media as this beautiful country, and he, you know, he loved it there. So it's kind of what happened to make him go from thinking that way, which was earlier in his travels, to thinking to you know, opening fire on two mosques. There are a number of, in his manifesto, he attributes his attitude towards his decision to commit this mass attack on a mosque or mosques to a number of things, various people who he said influenced him, and to various incidents that occurred, notably terrorist attack, radical Islamist terrorist attacks that killed people in Europe. And he identified with Europe. He says that in his manifesto. You know, I am European. In fact, he talks about how, where was that? He talks about how people, Australians, are drunk people from, from England, you know, are people who came to Australia, and they're just drunk. not very nice. But anyway, so he really identifies with Europeans. He says that I am European. And, you know, and yes, of course, Australia, you know, is a, belong to England. So he points to events, terrorist attacks by radical Islamists that murdered Europeans. And in fact, he talks about how when he was in France, he had an experience at a shopping center where he saw that Muslim immigrants outnumbered the French people by a huge margin. And he said that's when he had the epiphany that he was going to commit violence towards Muslims, because he calls this the invasion of immigrants. He was also angry in regard to France that Macron won, because he believes that Macron isn't going to be doing enough to stop this mass influx of Muslim immigrants into France, which, of course, is true. he also was inspired by the 2017 attack by Darren Osborne, who drove into worshippers outside the Finsbury Park Mosque in London. That was another example. He also was inspired by Anders Breivik, the terrorist who killed 69 kids of a workers' youth league on the island of Utøya in Norway in 2011. So, and he said he vowed to take revenge for the, quote, thousands of European lives lost to terror attacks. So basically, he was both trying to avenge the deaths of these Europeans who were dying and continue to die by immigrants. I mean, it's not just immigrants, but lots of examples of immigrants coming into Europe and perpetrating terror attacks. So it is both on behalf of the Europeans who died and also on behalf of, in a sense, the Australians and New Zealanders, because of seeing this influx beginning to happen there, particularly in New Zealand, where he was living after he came back from his 7-year tour, he was beginning to see the same thing happening in New Zealand and presumably in Australia as well. But he didn't want this to happen to the place that he also identified with, you know, that having grown up in Australia. And so he was seeing, you know, he had seen what happened to Europe, and he was seeing the beginnings of this happening to his, closer to his homeland. And this was, you know, as I said, to avenge the deaths of people who were already killed by terrorists in Europe, and to, and his anger at the people in Australia, New Zealand, who weren't doing enough to prevent these immigrants from settling there as well. So, also, he claims to have had a brief contact with Anders Breivik, you know, saying that he was inspired by him, and he claims to have had he doesn't describe what brief contact means, and Breivik's lawyer is denying that they had any contact, but we may find this out during the trial. Now, as I said earlier, 9 minutes before the attacks, he mailed his manifesto, which has been variously described as 73 pages, 87 pages. But anyhow, he emailed it to over 30 recipients, including the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who has gone on to try to bring forth a ban on automatic rifles. That is still being discussed, but she has put forth, according to her, she wants to ban these rifles, automatic rifles, so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again. And they raised the terrorism threat level to high for the first time in New Zealand when this was taking place. So, let me tell you some of the things that he said in his manifesto in regard to his visit to France. He described a town in eastern France as a, quote, cursed place. He wrote, quote, in every French city, in every French town, the invaders were there. No matter where I traveled, no matter how small or rural the community I visited, the invaders were there. For every French man or woman, there was double the number of invaders. I had seen enough, and in anger, drove out of the town, refusing to stay any longer in the cursed place, and headed on to the next town. So, you know, obviously, this is a man who, and as I was saying earlier about, he was partly inspired by the attack on the mosque in London. You know, that gave him to some degree an idea of doing that. You know, he also is said to have been inspired by other attacks on mosques. So basically, he came back to what was, you know, essentially his homeland, and not only to avenge, but as I said, to do what he could do to prevent this, or to take, you know, it was both a prevention and to avenge. Now, the title of his manifesto, he took from the work of the French anti-immigration writer Renaud Camus, and Camus' book was called Le Grand Remplacement, and so the manifesto of Brenton Tarrant was called the Great Replacement, and and let me read you some quotes about him, because I think what he writes about in regard to France, and he seems to be particularly upset about France, he said, quote, I found my emotions swinging between fuming rage and suffocating despair at the indignity of the invasion of France, the pessimism of the French people, the loss of culture and identity, and the farce of the political solutions offered. Now, of course, Camus is trying to say that he had nothing to do with it. I mean, to some extent, Brenton Tarrant blamed Trump. He blamed a number of people, but really, I mean, the blame is on him. On him. He also said in his manifesto, millions of people are pouring across our borders, invited by the state and corporate entities to replace the white people who have failed to reproduce, failed to create the cheap labor, new consumers, and tax base that the corporations and states need to thrive. This crisis of mass immigration and sub-replacement fertility is... That's an interesting way of calling it sub-replacement fertility. In other words, not procreating as quickly as Muslims are, is an assault on the European people that, if not combated, will ultimately result in the complete racial and cultural replacement of the European people. Now, you know, I mean, he is right. Not that I am not in any way endorsing what he did, of course not. But I have seen this with my own eyes, and what he's talking about in France and in Europe in general is right. So what's the solution? We need to find better solutions than to take one's anger and despair out on Muslims. But there does need to be a firmer stand taken by all the leaders of the European countries. Merkel in Germany, of course, is the worst, but in France it is incredibly bad as well. Because, by my saying this, I am not Islamophobic. However, I am a lover of the cultures in Europe. And I think whether it was immigrants, mass immigration of any people, any nationality, or any religion, it would not be good for the countries that are taking in an overpowering share of people from another culture. It doesn't matter that it was Muslim. I mean, yes, it matters in a way, in the sense that some... of course, some of the terrorist attacks were perpetrated by not normal Muslims, but by radical Islamists. Now, I just want to point out something. You know, this New Zealand attack is a great teachable moment for parents, because this is a time, an opportunity to talk about Islamophobia. And at the risk of sounding self-promotional, I want to make the point, because this is an example, I want to make the point that in my book, Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, Oh My, How to Protect Your Child in a Time of Terror, I talk in the part that's for grown-ups about how to prevent Islamophobia. And in the part for kids, the picture book part, that's the second half for kids, I have a picture of a little girl holding a teddy bear that says, I'm a Muslim and I'm not a terrorist. And I write, there's a long word called xenophobia. It means fear of strangers. Although you should report things or people who seem suspicious, it doesn't mean that you should suspect everyone who doesn't look like you or who comes from a different country or has a different religion than your family believes in. It's especially important to remember that not all Muslims are terrorists. Most Muslims want peace, just like we do. And some terrorists, like the ones who were born in America, may not even be Muslims. They are just traitors. So you should encourage your friends to get to know people and give them a chance to show you who they really are before assuming bad things about them. And that is absolutely true. And I hope that parents do take this opportunity to instill a more tolerant attitude in their children so that attacks like this don't happen again. Thank you for listening to the Terrorist Therapist Show. I'm Dr. Carol, your terrorist therapist.
If you would like to find out more about terrorism from me, your terrorist therapist, visit my website, terroristtherapist.com. And if you're a parent or teacher and want to build stronger nests for your kids to become more resilient, check out my new award-winning book, Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, Oh My, How to Protect Your Child in a Time of Terror. It's the first and only book about terrorism for kids. You can find it wherever books are sold or directly from the publisher at terrorismforkids.com. Terrorism4kids.com. I'm Dr. Carol, your terrorist therapist.
Thank you for listening to the Terrorist Therapist Show on Renegade Talk Radio with your host, Dr. Carol. We hope listening to the show has made you feel calmer, more resilient, and more able to reach your dreams despite living in a time of terror. You can also check out past shows on Renegade Talk Archives for more insights.